Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Nanotechnology may hold the key to incredible advances in a wide range of sciences, from treating diseases to creating better solar cells. But the long-term effects of the technology still are unknown. Coming up, we'll talk with a journalist who has been covering the issue and an expert in nanotechnology. But first, the use of nano-sized particles is not just part of some science fiction future. Nanoparticles are being used in many of the products we use every day. And they're being handled by everyday Americans who work in those manufacturing facilities. Columbus resident and novelist Carla Buckley has imagined that scenario in her new book, Invisible. Welcome back to the show, Carla.
Thank you, Anne.
Your last book, The Things That Keep Us Here, was about what might happen in the case of a serious pandemic. What inspired you to tackle nanotechnology next?
Well, when I sold my first book, which was the ninth novel I had written and the first one to be published, what I did was I imagined an average American family confronted with the worst that could fall, you know, play out across the world. And so in coming up with the idea for my second novel, I wanted to do the same thing. I wanted to look at the ordinary American facing an extraordinary but very real threat. And first I explored the idea of talking about global warming, which is actually very depressing. And the more research I did, the harder it became to think about writing about it. And so my husband, who is an environmental scientist, suggested that I talk about the energy crisis. And I said, well, that sounds like a real page-turner. So I did the research into that, and that was even grimmer. So I was kind of up against the wall. I had a deadline. I now had an editor, a publishing house that was expecting me to give them a book idea. And I was talking with a friend who had been to a think tank that week and listened to a lecture on nanotechnology. And she said to me, you know, what I think you should talk about is nanotechnology. And I thought, wow, I don't know anything about that. I wonder if there's something there. And so I went home and I began to do the research and found out that indeed there was a plethora of alarming things coming out of the research community about nanotechnology. So I decided that would be the theme of my second book.
One of the first points you make in the book regarding the technology is the trust that we tend to have in government. As far as the regulation goes, the protagonist in the story makes the assertion that if there were anything wrong, the Department of Health would have figured it out by now.
Exactly. Exactly.
But that's not necessarily the case.
Exactly. I think that as Americans, we do trust our government to a certain extent to keep us safe. A lot of things are regulated. And why wouldn't this technology, which, and for the listeners who don't know, nanotechnology is essentially taking ordinary elements such as silver and zinc and titanium and reducing them to a particle size, an unimaginably small particle
smaller
size.
Smaller by 1,000 times than the diameter of or the circumference of a piece of hair, a strand of hair.
Yeah, it's insane how tiny this is. And when those elements are, and I'm not a scientist, so all the caveats apply, but when those, my understanding is that when those elements are reduced to that size, they take on miraculous new properties. And that is what has caused manufacturing to jump in and industry to jump in and say, wait a minute, if we reduce silver to this nanoparticle size, then it becomes antibiotic. And wouldn't it be neat to put that on the handles of baby strollers? Well, wouldn't it be neat to put that in our clothing? And yes, it would be neat, but, and maybe I'm jumping ahead too far in this conversation, but the flip side of that is, and so all this began to happen, and the regulators have argued, my understanding is, that zinc is zinc, and if we regulate zinc at the macro level, then we don't really need to worry about it at the micro, the nano level, and that's where chaos has ensued because 20 or so years this technology has been going on, and what we have found is that, or what scientists have found, is that these particles are being released into the environment, into our ground, into our soil, into our water, into our air, and we cannot control it. We have no way of capturing it once it's released. because it's just too small. It escapes us. And scientists have begun to look at, well, what happens to the human body when it's exposed to these elements at that level? And they have found some alarming things.
My guest is Carla Buckley. She's the author of a new novel that uses the idea of nanotechnology. It's called Invisible. She's also author of The Things That Keep Us Here. If you have a question or comment for Carla, 614-292-8513. We're talking about nanoparticles and the technology that employs them. Coming up, we're going to hear from a journalist who has written about them extensively, and also a scientist from UC Santa Barbara who studies them as well. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You focused on one particular product, sunscreen, something that we're all using more of all the time to protect ourselves from another potential danger, skin cancer from exposure to ultraviolet rays. And nanoparticles are used for lots of other materials, from packaging for snack foods to multivitamins. Why did you focus on sunscreen?
I wanted to find something that the average person would use and would find in their medicine cabinet or in their beach bag in their homes. And when I did the research, I stumbled upon this study by a Southern Chinese research group, and they were the ones who found that nanozinc in laboratory animals caused kidney failure and massive organ failure. And I thought, whoa, nanozinc, that's used in sunscreen. So that led me back up the chain, and I began to focus on sunscreen as the benign and supposedly benevolent product in my story. The thing about sunscreen is that you really can't research the brands that deeply. Sunscreen manufacturers are very secretive about their products. And if you look at a tube of sunscreen, you will see it does not tell you that it contains nanozinc. However, the manufacturers who do not use nanozinc or nano titanium, they do label nano free. So
which brings me to another aspect of your research, perhaps the point of view of the manufacturers and how they're using it. Did you look into that? I mean, are they talking about this? Is it something that they're talking about and concerned about as manufacturers?
I could not access anything from the manufacturers themselves. They are silent on the topic. However, the consumer safety groups, the watchdogs, they talk about it quite a bit. There's a lot of discussion online about sunscreen.
Have you had any feedback from the industry since your book?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I'm waiting. And I really don't want this to be the story really isn't about bad industry. I don't think of industry as bad. And I use sunscreen every day. I'm fair-skinned, and I do worry about skin cancer. And so I weigh the pros and cons. And really, the point of my story is that we really did, as an industry or as a people, jump ahead of ourselves. Manufacturers began to use this product or these elements without first making sure they were safe.
Is this happening around the world, or is it primarily an American phenomenon? Or, if the Chinese are studying it, it's probably happening there as well.
It's absolutely global. And there's an interesting study in Australia where they found that the sunscreen of house painters, they found handprints, I'm misremembering this, but somehow there was a really scary study in Australia that showed, whoa, we better be looking at sunscreen. Look what it's doing to paint outdoors.
There is reference. There is a parallel theme throughout your book, which is very interesting. At the beginning of every chapter, it's about sea life. And one of the issues had to do with coral. In Australia, I think it was, they don't allow people who dive to see the corals
to put on sunscreen.
Because
exactly.
Because of that very reason?
Exactly, because it poisons the coral, which is really super fragile. And it's made me, the research I did for this novel has made me keenly and acutely sensitive to the concerns of what's going on in our coral reefs.
Another theme in the book, of course, is this is a manufacturing town in Minnesota. It's a small town that was, you know, doing a nosedive at one point. Now it's on the upswing. It's because of this product, and it does get into that conflict over the economy and economic well-being and long-term ignorance about the product.
Exactly. I think that a lot of us have to make a choice every day, maybe many times a day, over what is the right thing to do and what is the thing that I need to do in order to take care of my family.
You said that you still use sunscreen. And by the way, one of the things about the nanoparticles that make the reason why they're used in sunscreen is it's what makes it disappear so quickly.
Exactly.
On your skin now.
So it's cosmetically pleasing. Exactly.
You can put it in your, you know, the face, you know, lotions and all of that sort of thing. That's when they were able to do that.
And that's when people, and that is the reason people started to use sunscreen more often. It's ironic because sunscreen does protect us against the devastating UVA rays of the sun, UVB and UVA rays of the sun.
We know, you know, as you talked about the damage, the potential damage to the coral reefs and so forth from the nanoparticles of, I guess it's the zinc from sunscreen. Is there really any other research out there that points to any overt dangers from it yet?
Yes. Scientists have shown unquestionably that nano rods, which I think, and I hate to, you know, misquote myself or misquote the science, but I think it's nanoparticles can take two different or three different shapes, and one of them is nano rods, and elements at the nano rod level can be inhaled easily and take on the effects of asbestosis, mm-hmm. Which is really terrifying.
My guest once again, Carla Buckley, author of a novel. It's called Invisible. It's based on the premise of the exploding use of nanoparticles and nanotechnology in the United States and around the world, in everything from sunscreen to the packaging for our Pop-Tarts. If you have a question or comment for Carla, 614-292-8513. Coming up, a journalist, an environmental journalist who's been covering the issue as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. And it's 31 degrees. Expect a chance of some light snow this afternoon, a high near 36, partly cloudy tonight, and a low of 28. Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing non-medical home health care and companionship to seniors in Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Nanotechnology may hold the key to incredible advances in a wide range of sciences, from treating diseases to creating better solar cells, but the long-term effects of the technology still are unknown. Still with us is novelist Carla Buckley, whose latest book imagines the impact of nanotechnology and its mysteries on a small town in Minnesota. Joining us now is Britta Belli. She's a journalist who wrote about the use of nanoparticles in processed foods and food packaging for the December issue of E, the environmental magazine. Welcome to the show, Britta Belli.
Thanks for having me.
So nanotechnology is a relatively young industry. How young? Who spawned it? Where did it come from?
You know, we know, you know, and my research focused specifically on, you know, the impact on the food supply. Mm-hmm. And from what I could discover, it seemed as though for at least a decade we've had nanoparticles in our food and food packaging. But it's been so quietly introduced that, you know, it's very hard to get real facts and figures on this, particularly in terms of which products contain these nanomaterials, you know, and how prevalent it really is. So there are a lot of groups out there that are trying to, you know, compile this information and come up with some kind of comprehensive list for people, but that's still really in the early stages.
You know, when I was just looking at all the literature out there for myself, it seems like there's studies and there's groups popping up all over the world now, concerned about it and looking into it.
Right. I mean, this has become, you know, a new focus. I liken it to some of the issues people are taking with genetically modified foods, and you're seeing a lot of, you know, kind of consumer concern and groups coming forward saying, let's label these products and raising issues with it. You know, I think the nanoparticles is even less well understood and less well identified. So, but it's a similar type of fight where a lot of consumer advocacy groups, environmental health groups, are saying there's enough red flags here that we should at least be raising awareness, putting this on labels and informing people.
What I didn't find, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't find a lot of conflict per se. In other words, I see people and research groups out there with cautionary tales, with research that shows the dangers, criticism or concern about it, but I don't really see a group out there pushing back very much.
From what I found, a lot of the kind of major food manufacturers who have been asked about this issue have said that they're really taking a cautious approach. It doesn't seem that they want to really embrace this technology too much before really all the health data is out. But despite this, you know, the Food and Drug Administration has essentially allowed this, you know, without question into the food supply. So there's kind of, you know, some mixed messages, I think, out there. But it does seem as though food manufacturers have been rather cautious. That being said, they have their own scientists, you know, like Kraft Foods. They have their own scientists working on this technology. And if it's found, you know, to meet their satisfaction, they will, you know, this is going to become more and more of a common thing.
What do we know about what the government knows about nanoparticles in the first place?
Well, I contacted the FDA, and the spokesperson there told me that they do not keep track of nanoparticles in the food supply, and they could not reliably tell me where these particles are most often found because of the fact that they don't keep track. So literally, you know, it's really up to these consumer groups and researchers, of course, to kind of figure out to what extent these are there and what products they can be found in. So it's really, I found that very surprising, and I think a lot of people who read the piece did. I mean, the FDA is essentially admitting that they don't know, you know, and they're really not interested in finding out.
We're always hearing about the idea of overregulation, and I was wondering how something like nanotechnology could go unregulated. Is there anything that triggers regulation or the looking into regulation at the federal level?
If it were found kind of, you know, without doubt that there were some sort of health, you know, problem associated with these, it would have to trigger some sort of response at the federal level. But, you know, right now it's one of these situations where the technology has gotten ahead of the regulation and it's moving so quickly. And they're really doing a lot of studies and you know, the FDA has said that these are considered equivalent to their larger scale counterparts. And as long as the larger scale counterparts have been approved for the food supply, then these fall under the generally recognized as safe provision. And it's sort of a catch-all, you know, gray area where they've allowed a lot of these kind of not very healthy and suspect preservatives and various other additives that we see when we look at the back of labels and we're like, wait, what are these ingredients that we don't recognize? Mm-hmm. You know, it falls under that same provision.
And yet we know that nanoparticles, in many cases, are absolutely not the same composition as their larger counterparts.
Right, and that's what, you know, what the research is beginning to show and what scientists are saying is that, you know, these absolutely don't operate the same way in the body as the larger scale counterparts. Because of their small size, they're able to bypass the blood-brain barrier, go into our bloodstreams, and they can accumulate in our organs. But there just aren't the studies on the sort of long-term impacts yet. There's initial studies that are concerning, but there's not enough, you know, to really, I guess, to really force the FDA to take action other than some kind of general recommendations that they've put out, and that's as far as they've gone.
You know, when I did the research for my novel a couple of years ago, I found that the research was just coming out. Have you found that there have been increased numbers of studies?
There are definitely some. You know, as you mentioned, the one about the how the carbon nanotubes can lodge in your lungs and act like asbestos. I mean, that's something that's been out there. There are other studies showing that certain nanoparticles, when ingested, could, in terms, it was done in chickens, can block the absorption of iron, or it can increase the absorption of iron, depending on whether it was acute or chronic ingestion. So, they can have very subtle effects, they're finding, and they're not sure how yet those translate to humans. But, you know, we do know that they accumulate in organs. We know, you know, that these are, you know, acting in a different way in the body and could potentially have these kind of subtle effects in terms of our absorption of things like, you know, other necessary nutrients. So at this point, I mean, yeah, that's, I mean, it's still in the very early stages.
My guest, Britta Belli, she's a journalist who wrote about the use of nanoparticles in processed foods and food packaging for the December issue of E, the environmental magazine. Also with us is Carla Buckley. Her latest book imagines the impact of nanotechnology and its mysteries on a small town in Minnesota. The name of her book is called Invisible. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Britta Belli, in April, last April 2012, the Food and Drug Administration issued a draft guidance for the food industry. What's in that draft guidance, and has it changed anything?
You know, all that really said was, you know, it's up to manufacturers, food manufacturers, at their own discretion, if they feel that the use of nanomaterials in their product may in any way alter their product, then they might consider disclosing that on their label. And it's really left in that kind of vague, it's up to you kind of language. And so that was it. I mean, it was really, I think they felt some sort of pressure to address the issue, but they really, there's very little teeth behind it. I mean, and it's completely voluntary. So, you know, I think with the unknowns and the uncertainties with this technology, many manufacturers are not going to choose to put that on the label. It may, you know, it may steer customers in the other direction. So I think, you know, that hasn't had much impact.
I wondered if we can know if they're in the foods and products that we buy, wear, ingest, that sort of thing. In other words, could I call up the manufacturer of a product I want to eat and ask them, do you use nanoparticles? And can they say, we aren't going to tell you?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'm sure you could contact individually the companies. There is this group, the Woodrow Wilson Center, International Center for Scholars, that's attempted to put together a comprehensive list, but you know, as I said in my piece, it really isn't there yet. Especially when it comes to foods, they're better with other products than they are with foods, unfortunately. And but they even have an app associated with that. So hopefully, that will continue. You know, they'll continue to build that database of products. That would be terrific. And they're the only ones I know that are doing that. The other place, and this only applies to one type of nanoparticle, which is nanotitanium dioxide. There was research done that looked at different food products, and that was very specific in terms of which food products contained these particles and how much. And we have that in our piece, mm-hmm. and there's kind of a graph that goes along with it. But it's things like Betty Crocker whipped cream frosting and coffee creamer, a lot of candy like M&Ms, Good and Plenty.
Why are they used in food? What's the advantage?
Honestly, just for white pigment, mm-hmm. that's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of gums, candies, frosting type things, you know, will contain nanotitanium dioxide. Really, just for the pigment. I think it would, you know, it wouldn't be as appealing visually. You know, if the whipped cream frosting looked kind of gray, or you know. So that's yeah. You know, and of course, these are a lot of foods that, as I said before, I mean, they contain a lot of foreign ingredients and things that, you know, really aren't healthy. A lot of preservatives and additives and colorings and. So, you know, but I think what's worrisome and what that research found is that they sort of were able to to see, based on this, how much they think, you know, we're ingesting on a regular basis. And they found that they think that children probably are ingesting the most, you know, based on their small body size, but also the amount of, like, candy and sweets and things that they tend to eat. So, you know, I think without us knowing the long-term impacts, it's a little bit, you know, concerning that children are likely getting the most of these.
Chris in Granville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you. I was calling in regards to, years ago, I read an article about the benefits of nano silver against fighting cancer. And so I wanted to hear if you had any comments about that.
Well, I mentioned, Britta Belli, at the top, that nanotechnology may hold the key to incredible advances in things from fighting diseases and so forth. What do we know about nanosilver?
Well, I know it's been added to a lot of supplements, and it's interesting that came up because, I mean, the supplement aisle is the one place where you will find nanoparticles actually very proudly displayed on the label. You know, one of the advantages, of course, is it can deliver nutrients and things in a more concentrated way, in a way that's, you know, more bioavailable. The body can take up better and absorb better. And that's, you know, thought to be one of the great advantages of nanoparticles. You know, again, it's one of these issues where, you know, it could be too much of a good thing. I mean, if the body's absorbing too much of something, could it have a negative impact? Could it be, you know, reach an almost toxic level? So I think that's what they're kind of dealing with right now in terms of the research. You know, we actually have a sidebar in the piece that talks about, you know, all these, all the research that's being done in how all natural nanoparticles might better deliver nutrients and be added to foods, so that, you know, many of the supplements we take, we're not getting the full benefit of them, and they're able to deliver these nutrients better. So there are absolutely health benefits that come from these as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Bye-bye.
Why, Britta Belli, why are they using nanoparticles in packaging? What's the benefit there?
This is really to, you know, the nanosilver is one of the things that's being used in packaging. Nanoaluminum is another. They're being used to prevent spoilage, to increase shelf life. So that they're very good at these antimicrobial functions. And that's, you know, a huge use in the food industry, is really to prevent spoiling so we can keep things on shelves longer. There's even consideration of coating fruits and vegetables with nanoparticles in order to preserve them longer and to make them last longer. So that's, you know, I mean, obviously it's a huge advantage in the food industry. We, you know, it has great potential. The concern is that those nanoparticles that are in the packaging are migrating into the foods themselves.
Is that why some of the packaging is so much thinner now than it used to be?
I mean, certainly it's helped with the advances, and yeah, I mean, that is part of it. And I know with the nanoaluminum, I'm sure that's the case as well.
Some pretty big players, including McDonald's, are opting out of the nano-engineered materials. But McDonald's, I think I read it in your article, is the exception. You wrote that when it comes to informing the public, McDonald's tells people they don't use it.
Right, and McDonald's actually mistakenly ended up on that list that the Woodrow Wilson Center had put together, their milkshake specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, prompted them to really have a real public disclaimer that, look, we don't, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around these nano-engineered materials, so as of now, we're not using them. One of the things that this consumer group, As You Sow, SOW, found when they were, you know, they're very big on this issue, was that a lot of these food companies aren't really aware if it's being used, particularly in their packaging. So I think that's really what needs to, you know, begin to happen is for these companies to even just go back and ask their suppliers if they're being used. Right now, there's just a real lack of disclosure. So it may be happening against their knowledge. And that's, you know, and many of them admitted that they really didn't know. So whether or not it's in their food supply, you know, the packaging presents another, you know, kind of route of exposure. It's not really being addressed.
Any other big companies that are taking the route that McDonald's has?
Not that I know of. Not that have made a real public statement about it. But all of them seem to be, you know, according to this group, As You Sow, who talked to, like, Whole Foods and Yum Brands, PepsiCo, Kraft Foods, they're all looking into it. They're all approaching it with caution. And they all seem to be, you know, at least considering the more disclosure route, going back and asking their manufacturers. So they're working with this group, and they're you know, so it seems that they're, you know, willing participants at least. But, you know, it's really now this kind of state of uncertainty still.
Looking at it from another point of view, something that Carla Buckley brought up in her book, the manufacturing process itself and the people who are on the lines making these products, what about their health and safety? What about OSHA? Is OSHA looking into this at all? Well, I should say that's the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. I mean, Occupational Safety and Health.
I don't know in terms of what the regulations are there for workers, but certainly, like, when we're talking about the inhaled, the carbon nanoparticles, for instance, I mean, those are found in a lot of electronics, and because they present this worry that they can work essentially like asbestos when inhaled, I mean, that would be something that would be of particular concern to people working in manufacturing computer and computer parts and that sort of thing, as well as I would imagine people who are at the end of life, the recycling end of things. So, you know, it absolutely presents a worry for workers. And that type of exposure, because of the small size and the ability to be inhaled, you know, it's a very kind of acute route of exposure. You know, ingestion is worrisome as well, but they both are. And certainly workers who I would think, especially with electronics, that sort of thing, would have to follow certain regulations.
And you put your finger on one of the elements that surprised and worried me the most was that it's almost impossible to protect yourself against these particles because of their size.
Right, exactly. I mean, we know that they bypass everything, really. You know,
right.
They bypass everything
right.
In the body.
There's no mask.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, any filtration systems we have for water, they bypass. I mean, so there really are, you know, that's another really an issue is that, I mean, are these going to continue to build up in the environment and in our bodies and present a real hazard down the road that we haven't really imagined yet?
My guests are Britta Belli, a journalist and editor at E! The Environmental Magazine. We're talking about an article she wrote for the issue in November, December 2012 about nanoparticles and the use of nanotechnology in the food system in the United States and around the world. Also with us, Carla Buckley. She's a novelist. Her latest book is Invisible. It imagines a world and a small town where the manufacturing, the big company in town is dependent on nanotechnology. Coming up, we're going to meet an expert in nanotechnology and talk to him about the work they're doing to learn more about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the manuscripts dating back to the time of Jesus that were found between 1947 and 1956 in caves by the Dead Sea. Why were they there? Who wrote them? Why were Jews prevented from joining the first panel of scholars interpreting the scrolls? We talk with John Collins, author of The Dead Sea Scrolls, a biography. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. 32 degrees with cloudy skies. Expect a high of 42 today. There's also a chance of some light snow. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 28 degrees. A slight chance of some light snow on Thursday. Otherwise, we'll see partly sunny skies and a high of 48. Clouds for Thursday night and a low of 30 degrees. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Tim Crouch in I, Malvolio, the wildly comic take on Shakespeare's notoriously wrong character from The Twelfth Night. February 14th to the 17th in the Wexner Center Performance Space. Details and tickets at wexarts.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
¶¶ Nanotechnology may hold the key to incredible advances in a wide range of sciences, from treating diseases to creating better solar cells, but the long-term effects of the technology still are unknown. Coming up, joining us now to talk about that is Dr. Arturo Keller. He is a co-director of the University of California Center for the Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology. Welcome to the show, Dr. Keller.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
We were just talking about the filtration issue and the fact that there's really no way to filter these things out. They're so small, no one's come up with a way to do that yet. Is that still the case, or are they working on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of questions about nanotechnology and how it gets applied, and that one is one that has, you know, piqued the interest, of course, of environmental scientists like myself. And there are filters that can remove them, but more importantly, the nanoparticles, you can get them to aggregate to form, you know, bigger clusters of nanoparticles fairly easily. And so we found out, you know, by working with them, we had to figure out how to remove them from our experiments. And so by adding simple additives that are used for normal water treatment, you're able to actually filter them out and coagulate them out so that they come out of the water and, you know, the concentrations are really, really low at that point. So there are different ways, and one can handle that. So, of course, there is a concern, and we need to pay attention because our waste and water treatment plants don't normally deal with these materials. So they need to be aware that these may be in the water supplies that they're using, but there are ways to get rid of them.
Are those ways to get rid of them being used a lot around the world or around the country, or is this a new technology in itself?
It's not being used specifically for nanotechnology because most, I would say 99.99% of our water supplies have not been impacted by nanomaterials, which is great. In fact, one of the issues working in this field is that we have no smoking gun, we have no spill, we have nothing, which is good for the technology, but it just makes it hard to justify the research. But anyway, the technology that's out there is available. It's off-the-shelf technology. We don't need something really special for the removal of these nanomaterials in terms of getting them to coagulate and to aggregate into larger particles that then settle out. Just like, you know, if you had suspended sediments or anything else in your waters, you could just add these coagulants, which are used normally by water suppliers, to remove the particles.
So there's kind of two issues, is whether or not in the long term nanoparticles are, in whatever iteration they occur, are safe for humans or the environment. And number two, once they're out there, is there a way to pull them back?
Yes, right. So yes, and if we look at nanomaterials in general, our center, which has been operating now for 4 years, and we have, you know, been doing work for even longer, but some of it individually, we've sort of classified nanomaterials into three categories. There's the category that is generally very unreactive from the perspective of biological systems, and, you know, those don't really show anything that we're concerned with. Then there's the medium class where, you know, there's a lot of gray areas there we're still trying to figure out. And some of the previous speakers mentioned some of these. For example, the shape is a very important factor. The nanorods and those things really are really a high concern regardless of the composition. And then there's the ones that are on the high end of, you know, concern. And those are the ones like the zinc that was mentioned or silver. Because of the fact that they dissolve and they provide then free zinc and free silver into the waters that may be there. And so those may have a longer-term implication. If we continue to use them on a regular basis, we're going to begin to accumulate these elements, zinc, silver, and others, that are of concern. And although they may eventually be removed by different processes in the environment, it may be that before that they interact with, you know, organisms, they interact with humans, and so that will be a concern. So there's the short-term exposure questions, and there's the longer-term chronic exposures that we're all concerned with.
You're listening to Dr. Arturo Keller. He is the co-director of the University of California Center for the Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology. Still with us, Carla Buckley, novelist. Her latest book is called Invisible. And also Britta Belli. She's a journalist and editor at E! The Environmental Magazine. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. /allsides. Sharon in Dayton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
With these particles being so small are that can't be seen, are these particles being purposely put in these products? And if so, how do they do it? You can't buy a bag of it.
It's hard to comprehend. Dr. Keller?
Yes, you know, that was the first question when we first started working with nanomaterials. You know, what would you get? And, you know, they actually look like, when you buy them, they are either powders, very fine powders. They look like talc, if you have already worked with talc, very, very, very fine particles. But in fact, they are, you know, you can actually see the particles at that level when you have the big bag in front of you. If you buy them already in a suspension, you know, many of our products out there, a suspension is something like milk. So milk doesn't have nanoparticles naturally, but it certainly has that kind of, you know, look of, you know, if you dilute it, you'll start seeing the different particles in the milk. Anyway, so that's what you get. And they are added to the foods either as powders or sometimes they will suspend the particles in water first and then put them into whatever the product they're interested in. So that's the typical application. And as I was mentioned, it's to enhance color, to enhance flavors. Sometimes it's to provide longer shelf lives by having preservation, antimicrobials, and things like that.
Sharon, thanks a lot for your call. Take care. We have an email from Susan in Cleveland Heights. She asks, what happens to the packaging that is then disposed of and gets into the environment? Any idea of the shelf life of nanoparticles beyond the intended use? I shudder to think of antimicrobials in the environment. Yes. Dr. Keller?
Yes, and that's a key question, and we really appreciate that. We've been doing a lot of work on what we call life cycle assessment. So this is an analysis of what's the pathway for these materials as they go from the time they're manufactured when they first become nano, and then they get put into consumer products that then go out and get used by everyone, and then they get disposed, and, you know, we have to figure out, so they go to landfills, or they go into incinerators, or they're disposed directly in the environment. So we're putting together these assessments, and it's a really open question. We know that many of these materials will end up in landfills, and the question is, do our landfills have the capacity to filter out? Here's where filtration becomes an open question. Do they filter out these nanomaterials? We think that because of the way they're disposed, most of them will be retained, but we don't know if all of them, and that's the concern, that, you know, there could be some leaching out, particularly from older landfills, which are not really designed for these types of materials. No?
Carla Buckley's book is about a manufacturing facility that uses nanoparticles to produce their lotions and their sunscreens and so forth. But somebody else is producing the nanoparticles as well. And I'm wondering, what about the people that work in those manufacturing facilities? I asked Britta Belli earlier about OSHA standards to protect workers. Do you know anything about that, Dr. Keller?
Yes. So there's been a lot of, obviously, interest and concern from the part of the regulatory agencies. There's a National Nanotechnology Initiative that all of these agencies work with, and they coordinate to try to address these different concerns. So OSHA and the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Human Health, or NIOSH, they look at these questions, and what they've done is they are providing guidance to manufacturers of nanomaterials, as well as the companies that use them to put them into products, to better understand how to handle them. These are very fine powders, and so as was mentioned, I think it was by Britta, the inhalation issue is a big concern. People, you know, working in those environments, so you have to have special fume hoods, you have to have special equipment to handle them. And by and large, you try to get them out of the powder form as soon as possible into a suspension so that they're a lot less of a concern. So there's been a lot of work in that area. We did do a study. A colleague of mine, Barbara Herharthen, did a study where she found that most manufacturers were aware of the guidance, but many were not using them yet, which was a concern that they, although they know that guidance is out there, they are not necessarily applying it all. And it's because it's not yet regulation where you have to actually enforce it. But regulation is on its way in that respect.
Can anything be made into a nanoparticle?
Just talking with my material science colleagues, I would think almost everything, any material could eventually be made nano. It's amazing the types of things that they can do. Of course, there are different ways of making nanomaterials. So some elements lend themselves easier for making them into nano. But yes, there's nanopolymers, there's nanocellulose, nanoclays, all sorts of things, nanometals, of course, and the carbon nanotubes and other really fancy nanomaterials.
How are they made? Is it something like a smashing process? I mean, how does it happen? I mean, these are the dumb questions of the hour. How do you take silver and make it nano?
I get that question all the time, and I ask that question first because I'm not a material scientist myself. And so most of the time it's not made by crushing or by grinding because that actually takes a lot of energy. Many of them are made either by you put the elements of interest into water and then you make them react. And as they begin to just come together, the first few atoms then come together, you stop the reaction and you make a nanoparticle. So they're slightly larger than a molecule. They're about 25, 50, 100 molecules put together. That's one way. Another way is to put the suspension into a flame, a very fine flame, and you spray them, and they form these very fine mists, and then because of the flame, it dries up and it forms the nanoparticles. There's other more advanced technologies. For example, to make the graphenes, or other materials, they use vapor deposition, so they put them into the vapor, and then it deposits onto kind of a mask that makes the very fancy nanomaterials. So those are kind of the typical ways.
Britta Belli, you wrote about the Safe Chemicals Act, which passed a Senate committee in July. What would that do, and what's its prognosis in the new session of Congress?
I mean, there's not a lot of hope for it, I mean, given that there are so many other pressing concerns, particularly, with the economy. But, there's been a lot of consumer movement and a lot of groups kind of rallying behind the Safe Chemicals Act, and this would really deal with all chemicals. So basically forcing everything to sort of start from scratch to prove, the environmental safety and the safety for human health before these could be approved. And this would be a way of updating our very outdated Toxic Substances Control Act, which grandfathered in, 60,000 plus chemicals. Really everything, our understanding of what chemicals can do in small amounts has changed so much since that time. My understanding is that this wouldn't deal with nanoparticles directly, but it may be in a roundabout way it would. If something being added to any product changed the composition of that product, it would fall under that regulation. So they're thinking that nanomaterials would, in a roundabout way, be covered by it. It would at least be a starting point in terms of regulating these particles, and perhaps as that law unfolds, could actually maybe address it in a more direct way.
Dr. Keller, I mean, the cow's sort of out of the barn, right? What sort of testing could be done fast enough to manage this exploding industry of nanotechnology? Is the regular course of safety testing going to be enough? Because that is very time-consuming.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. One of the things that we are doing in our center, and that's one of the reasons why NSF and EPA funded us, is that we have a high-throughput screening testing system, which is kind of our flagship experimental setup. It basically takes these nanoparticles, and we can run thousands of tests on different cells. These are cells that have been taken, for example, from different organisms. So we have fish cells, and we have bacteria, and we have some mice cells, and even some human cells, the cells by themselves, that can be tested and exposed to see how do they respond. And the test usually takes about 24 hours, sometimes a little longer. And so you can, again, run a lot of these tests on a daily basis, and that allows us to screen through and figure out which are the nanoparticles that are most likely to be a concern. We have, of course, hypotheses, but then we go and test them and we find, okay, this is the one that, is really showing up as, giving us a high signal for toxicity. We can also look at shapes. We can look at mixtures. We can look at, what if you have these particles with those particles and, even particles with other molecules that we may want to see whether it inhibits or increases the effect of the nanoparticle. So that's one way to speed things up. And then the rest of our center looks at, okay, now let's take that high throughput screening test and see what happens when you actually expose them to, organisms in uncontrolled conditions so that we can see what happens to bacteria in soils. Are they affected? Is that going to affect the production of crops? We also expose, for example, corn and soybean to see if these nanoparticles are used in agriculture, which there's a good push to do that. What's the effect? that on plants, both crops as well as wild plants. Anyway, so we're doing a lot of that testing to be able to answer these questions on a timely basis so that we can make a better use of nanotechnology.
One of the reasons I was so keenly interested in discussing nanotechnology was the fact that it is a global phenomenon. So while we in America are taking these initial steps, what about the concern that what's going on in, for example, China, how does that, where they may not be as concerned? And I don't mean to be apolitical.
Well, you're talking about, like, sometimes we have pollution from
exactly.
around the world. Is that mm-hmm. the sort of thing that could be of concern, Dr. Keller? Can we control it that much?
By and large, most, if nanoparticles are used, let's say, in China or manufactured in China, and there are releases to the atmosphere, which there could be for sure, so our science shows that, in general, they will form these aggregates. They will, you know, coagulate and form larger particles. And so we may not be getting the nanoparticles directly if they blow over. We could be getting these aggregates. And one of the questions then is, do they disaggregate as they deposit? And so we're asking those questions and doing experiments to figure that out. But so that it is a concern.
It seems like the business or the industry that you're in, Dr. Keller, is exploding as well to try to catch up with pretty much a decade of nanotechnology in use.
That's correct. We're kind of on a catch-up mode. I think there was a lot of funding for the applications for quite a while, you know, about a decade ahead of us, and we're now catching up to try to figure out, okay, so there's these great applications, but what are some of the concerns, and where should we be paying attention to the use of these nanomaterials?
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it and start the conversation here. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dr. Arturo Keller, he's the co-director of the University of California Center for the Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology. Also with us, Britta Belli, journalist and editor at E! The Environmental Magazine. They have an extensive article in the E! Magazine. Website there is emagazine.com. Britta, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Also, novelist Carla Buckley, her latest book, it's called Invisible, and it imagines the impact of nanotechnology in a small town in Minnesota. Carla, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.